Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I had a dog growing up. Show you a picture of him. Black, white feet, white throat, little white tip on his tail. I loved that dog. That dog knew when I was going to service. He knew when I got in trouble. He knew when I was phoning home. He'd come up, lay on the porch, and look at the phone. And it'd ring if it was from me. He'd bark like wild, make sure somebody answered the phone. You know what his name was? Nigger.
Nigger!
And that was your dog?
That's right. I loved that dog. That wasn't no bad name. That's because he was black, shiny, pretty, muscular. Come on, nigger. You see? I wasn't using it in a bad way. They were run out of town not because they were black. They were run out of Corbin because they were drinking, gambling, and raising all kinds of cane with their newfound pocket money from the railroad.
Context of white supremacy. Did you hear Dixie as it was fading out? That's the fast version. We normally do the slower version of Dixie, but that theme song of the context of white supremacy. Man, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, April 18th. 2019, so I have been told. This is our book club part 7 on suspected racist James Loewen's Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. The audio segment that we heard, brief snippet, the documentary Trouble Behind, documentary on Corbin, Kentucky. They are one of the many spots that are discussed in Sundown Towns where they drove out the Negros. And you heard one of the white residents in Corbin talking about his dog, Nigger. And that's one of the things that's going to be discussed this week. In my view, Mr. Loewen is practicing white supremacy racism deliberately by calling these myths as opposed to lies. Again, he has written an entire book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, so it seems that he is, in some context, comfortable with just saying that people are lying. This, for whatever reason, is not one. Anyway, what he said about they drove the Negros out, not his dog, but the Negros, they drove the Negros out, not because they were black, but they were driven out because they were drunkards and gambling and raising all kinds of sane. That is why they drove out the Negros. Certainly, white people don't do anything like that. Gambling, drinking, raising, saying. Whites don't do that. Anyway, we will get to it. Really be mindful. Like I said, I am using my brain computer because I am learning a lot of information. However, in my view, Mr. Loewen is practicing racism regularly. So try to be mindful of both. Context of white supremacy. James Loewen. Sundown Towns, audio segment number 1.
Chapter 7. Catalysts and Origin Myths. An item in the Chesterton Tribune in 1903 explains why and how that northern Indiana town went all white. About 40 years ago, Negroes began to settle in this township in numbers. And it wasn't long before they became a nuisance. Stealing was rife, and all kinds of depredations were going on. Ned Harrigan, who lived here at the time, says that the whites met at the school building and decided to clear the country of the blacks. A notice was served on the offenders, giving them 24 hours to get out of town. And by noon the next day, every Negro shanty was empty. And that was the last that was ever heard of them. Most residents of the typical sundown town aren't good sociologists and never invoke factors such as those given in the previous chapter, political ideology, ethnic makeup, and the like, to explain their town's racial policy. For that matter, the underlying sociological causes don't flatly determine the outcome in a given community. Not every democratic town expelled its African Americans, although democratic towns did so far more often than Republican towns. Not every monoethnic town kept blacks out, although monoethnic towns did so more often than multi-ethnic towns. Not every town with strong white supremacist labor unions drove out all its African Americans, although many did. However, as racism intensified during the Nadir, the position of African Americans in towns marked by any or all of these three factors grew so tenuous that the least disturbance, an incendiary remark by a demagogic white politician, news of the next town getting rid of its blacks, a criminal act by a black resident, might set off an expulsion. What residents of a sundown town often do recall is the immediate reason why its African Americans were expelled, the trigger. These events play the role of catalysts. If the underlying conditions are right, just as a catalyst in a chemical reaction provides a surface or hook enabling the reaction to proceed more rapidly, so the triggering incident provides an excuse or justification for the expulsion or prohibition of African Americans. In most towns that had African Americans and then had none, some account of this triggering event persists in the local culture to explain their absence. This story then gets raised to the level of myth and becomes used not only as the sole reason for the original expulsion, but also to justify the town's continuing exclusion of African Americans. Labor strife as excuse. One underlying cause, organized labor and racialized labor strife, is often cited by residents as the cause of their town's sundown policy. In some towns, however, black strikebreakers were not the real reason for a town going sundown, but only the pretext. This may have been true in Linton, Indiana, for example, which barred all African Americans after a coal company attempted to use black strikebreakers. In the summer of 1903, union miners made a riotous attack upon the colored waiters at Linton, according to a newspaper account. Linton put up a sundown sign, and all of Greene County, of which Linton is the seat, went sundown, according to a history teacher who grew up in nearby Vincennes. A black family tried to move into the county in the late 1940s, she said, and was burned out. No one black would ever dare live in Linton, she told me in 2002. And as of the 2000 census, 5,774 people lived in Linton, but there was not one black household. The colored waiters had nothing to do with any strikebreakers, however. Indeed, nothing to do with mining. White coal miners in Linton were hardly in competition with waiters. So the motivation for the 1903 riotous attack wasn't economic. The mining strike seems just an excuse for a more general policy. As in Linton, workers in Austin, Minnesota expelled not only black strikebreakers, but all African Americans. In Oshkosh, Wisconsin, according to Andrew Kirchmeyer, professor at nearby Ripon College, unions had an agreement with the city, not the employers, to keep African Americans out of town as a matter of municipal policy. Perhaps unions in each city felt that the easiest way to guarantee that black strikebreakers would never trouble them again would be to give their town a reputation for being inhospitable to all African Americans. Or perhaps workers were simply acting on their racist beliefs, shared by their political and labor leaders. Moreover, unions didn't have to be racist to succeed. So it's fallacious to credit black strikebreakers with causing a town to go sundown. Labor had examples of non-racist practice, such as DuQuoin, Illinois, where the United Mine Workers organized an interracial union. There, when managers tried to engage blacks as strikebreakers, unionized African Americans were on hand to dissuade them. The town stayed interracial, the mines stayed organized, and DuQuoin has long been an oasis of racial tolerance compared to its neighboring communities, most of which are sundown towns. It even elected a black alderman in 1918. Thus, racism didn't flow automatically as a result of social class or union membership. Some sundown towns invoked labor disputes long after the fact as an excuse. Miners in Carterville, Illinois, 130 miles south of Panna, faced African-American strikebreakers in 1898. Like the mine owners in Panna, Samuel Brush, who operated the biggest mine in Williamson County, just north of Carterville, refused to pay the Springfield scale agreed to by other mine owners with the United Mine Workers. 4/5 of his workers struck. Brush replaced them with 178 African-American miners from Tennessee. 2 years of intermittent labor disputes, often marked by violence, followed. On September 17, 1899, some 25 or 30 whites confronted about 15 African Americans at the Illinois Central Railroad station and ordered them to get out of town. The blacks started walking up the railroad tracks, with the whites following at a distance. According to historian Paul Angle, suddenly, one of the Negroes drew a pistol and fired at the group of pursuers. The miners answered with a volley. Several of the Negroes fell. The others ran for their lives. The whites followed, firing at the fugitives. In a few minutes, not a black man could be seen. 5 lay dead. The others, some of them wounded, escaped to the safety of the mining camp. To this day, some residents of Carterville explain the town's sundown policy by referring to the black scabs. Historian Herbert Gutman took this position in The Negro and the UMW. It turns out, however, that Carterville already was a sundown town before the importation of the strikebreakers. As Angle noted, Carterville had long imposed on the Negro a subhuman status. No colored person was permitted even to enter the town. On the knife edge. While black strikebreakers have been wrongly invoked to excuse sundown policies, their actions can never logically justify expelling African Americans who were not strikebreakers. Nevertheless, labor strife does qualify as a catalyst. Often, whether a town went sundown came down to such small moments in time as whether a strike was won or lost. If the strikers lost, some striking miners came back to work, joining some of the African-American strikebreakers. In the few Pennsylvania towns where African-Americans do reside today, in most cases they are the descendants of strikebreakers, according to Philip Jenkins, author of a study of the Ku Klux Klan in Pennsylvania. Other interracial towns resulting from strikebreakers include Coal Creek, Indiana, Braidwood and Danville, Illinois, Waterloo, Iowa, and Weir City, Kansas. If the union was smart, which the United Mine Workers of America often was, it then organized white and black workers so as not to be undercut by black strikebreakers in the future. Sometimes a truly insignificant incident made the difference. Mine owner Joseph Leiter was about to sign with the United Mine Workers in a meeting with UMW leaders in Ziegler, Illinois, in June 1904, a month before the strike. Then, in Alan Patton's words, according to local legend, John Wesley Chadone, one of the local UMW union officials, made a loud boast of the union conquest of Leiter. Immediately, Leiter threw the pen that he held to sign the agreement into the wall and threw the contract at Chadone. In a loud voice, Leiter stated that Ziegler will run scab forever. What if Chadone had not made his intemperate remark? Then Leiter would have signed with the interracial UMW, and Ziegler might not be a sundown town today. Other events showed how tenuous was the position of African Americans in towns poised on the knife edge owing to the town's underlying characteristics. On July 4, 1910, for example, black heavyweight Jack Johnson defeated Jim Jeffries, the great white hope, in Reno, Nevada. African Americans rejoiced in the victory of one of their own until they came up against the response of white Americans to Jeffries' defeat. Whites attacked African Americans in at least 30 American cities. In Slocum, Texas, they killed 20. All others fled. So Slocum became a sundown town in response to a boxing match more than 1,000 miles away. This is what historians call historical contingency. If Johnson had lost, blacks might have survived in Slocum. Claims to equality led to sundown towns. The real reason that Jack Johnson's victory led to at least one sundown town and to many attacks on African American neighborhoods was that he demonstrated that blacks could be the equal of whites, at least in the boxing ring. During the nadir, that was a dangerous claim for an African American to make. Indeed, Johnson boldly maintained that he was socially equal to whites as well, openly dating and marrying white women. Whites have often been unwilling to concede that African Americans might be their equal in wealth, social status, or even more minor skills such as boxing or poker, and their anger at the possibility often triggered sundown towns. Whites might claim to be upset by problematic African Americans, criminals and ne'er-do-wells, but more frequently they lashed out at those who were industrious and successful. For it was these families whose existence set up a claim to social and economic equality. Such claims underlay the expulsion by white Democrats of about 200 African Americans from Washington County, Indiana, shortly after the Civil War. The earliest victim of the violence was John Williams, who had acquired a farm and an unusual amount of wealth for a Negro, in the words of historian Emma Lou Thornborough. In December 1864, he was shot to death in his own dooryard. In 1867, there was another murder, the victim being an inoffensive old man who had aroused the ire of some of his white neighbors by persisting in attending their church, even after he'd been warned to stay away. These and other terrorist actions led to an exodus, and Washington County remained all white until 1990. To achieve wealth or attend church implied that African Americans were the social equals of whites, which these Indiana whites would not tolerate. In the larger riots for which we have more information, such as the 1908 attempt in Springfield, Illinois, and the 1921 attempt in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to cleanse these cities of African Americans, we can see the same dynamic at work. Margaret Ferguson, an African American trying to avoid the mob in Springfield, pointed out, "There was a great deal of animosity toward any well-established Negro who owned his own house and had a good job." Rioters there specifically targeted William Donegan, an elderly African American who had been Abraham Lincoln's cobbler. His sin, besides his race itself, was that he was prosperous, and also that he'd been married to a white woman for over 30 years. The mob cut his throat and hanged him. "They were very busy hurting the prominent," Ferguson wrote later, "and so, of course, we were frightened, you see, because we also were affluent." In Tulsa, too, whites particularly targeted successful middle-class families. Sometimes the affront may seem trivial until we recognize that a claim for equality was involved. In Owosso, in central Michigan, on October 4, 1871, African-American residents held a party, complete with an Italian band. Some white residents apparently tried to crash it, and the African-Americans said they were not welcome, since blacks had been ejected from a white masquerade ball some months earlier. An argument ensued. The blacks ousted the whites and beat them on the street. The white community returned en masse and forced all African Americans out of town. Sometimes direct economic competition between small business owners engaged in the same trade played a role. In 1892, when whites in Norman, Oklahoma first drove out their black residents, an African American named Dahl Smith, a barber, received a note of warning. "You are hereby notified to leave this town in the next 10 days. We are determined that no nigger shall live in this town. We give you timely warning to get your things and git, or you must stand the consequences." Smith did leave. And 9 months later, when whites forced the black residents of nearby Lexington to flee, a white barber, George Elkins, played a leading role. In Lexington, according to the Guthrie, Oklahoma News, Negro men were tied up and beaten, and Negro women outraged. Federal District Court indicted 20 whites, but the cases were continued for a year and finally dismissed. In November 1920, African Americans in Ocoee, Florida, west of Orlando, made a still more serious claim to equality. They tried to vote. A Republican judge, John Cheney, facilitated their registration, which outraged white Democrats, who dominated much of Orange County. The Grand Master of Florida Ku Klux sent the following notice to Judge Cheney. "If you're familiar with the history of the days of Reconstruction, which followed in the wake of the Civil War, you'll recall that the scalawags of the North and the Republicans of the South proceeded very much the same as you are proceeding, to instill into the Negro the idea of social equality. You'll also remember that these things forced the loyal citizens of the South to organize clans of determined men who pledged themselves to maintain white supremacy and to safeguard our women and children. And now, if you're a scholar, you know that history repeats itself, and that he who resorts to your kind of a game is handling edged tools. We shall always enjoy white supremacy in this country, and he who interferes must face the consequences. On Election Day, two prosperous African-American landowners in Ocoee, Mose Norman and Julius Perry, went to the polls. Democratic officials turned them away. Norman later returned with a shotgun, insisting that he be allowed to vote. An altercation ensues, in the words of Bianca White, co-director of a documentary film on the incident, and Mose Norman is pistol-whipped and sent away a second time. Mose Norman is never heard from again. Colonel Sam Salisbury then organized a lynch mob to punish Norman and Perry for trying to vote. By nightfall, white residents of Ocoee, joined by more than 250 Klansmen from around the state, collected in the town and attacked its black neighborhoods. More than 300 African Americans fled for their lives into the orange groves, swamps, and neighboring towns. Many were burned in their homes or shot as they fled them. 25 homes, 2 churches, and a Masonic lodge were incinerated. The death toll was between 8 and 60. Perry's body was found hanging from a light pole the next morning. For nearly a week, deputized Klansmen held the city. They divvied up the land owned by African Americans and sold it for $1.50 an acre. Ocoee stayed all white until 1981. Until 1921, residents of Montlake, then a small coal mining town, now a suburban area near Soddy Daisy in East Tennessee, drew their water from a centrally located spring, the only one available for general use, according to an article in the Chicago Defender, the nation's premier black newspaper. As segregation grew stricter during the nadir, whites grew less willing to countenance the equality of status implied by sharing a spring. The prejudice of the whites had made them try to keep anyone but themselves from using the spring, in the Defender's words. On several occasions, individuals have had fights over the water, and in a number of instances, the whites have been worsted. It's felt that this condition led to the circulation of reports that if anything should happen again, the whites were going to band together to force the other residents from their homes. At this point, a black girl, 8-year-old Jewel Flipper, went to the spring for water. 4 white girls apparently stopped her. An altercation ensued, and in the aftermath, whites drove out the entire African-American population, some 60 miners and their families. After driving them out, the whites guarded the streets, went into the cabins, and took all of value, and kept anyone from entering the town by way of the roads. Decades later, according to oral history, Soddy Daisy sported a sign that said, "Niggers fun, look and run." Threat of school desegregation led to sundown towns. School desegregation presented a similar claim of equality. We saw that school desegregation was involved in Herman, Missouri, which proved unable to find a stable equilibrium between the equality implied by common schooling and the stigma of total exclusion. Segregation embodies the idea that African Americans are an inferior people with whom whites must never have equal social contact. For that reason, among others, in 1954, the United States Supreme Court struck down the system of racial segregation in American education. Brown v. Board of Education ordered schools to desegregate, clearly as a first step toward ending segregation in all aspects of public life. Towns as far north as Topeka, Kansas, Washington, D.C., and southern Illinois struggled to comply, while whites in deep south towns struggled not to comply. Sheridan, Arkansas, coped with Brown by getting rid of all its African Americans. Shortly after the 1954 edict came down from the Supreme Court, the all-white Sheridan School Board voted to comply, a constructive step taken by only two other towns in Arkansas. Sheridan had been operating an elementary school for African Americans, but was busing its black high school students to adjacent counties. The decision to desegregate led to a firestorm of protest in the white community, in the words of a Sheridan native, which led to a new meeting the next night at which the school board unanimously reversed itself. Thereafter, as told in Chapter 4, Sheridan's entire black community was induced to leave town, leaving Sheridan all white on purpose. Thus, Sheridan, which would have been one of the most racially progressive towns in Arkansas if its initial school board decision had stood, instead became one of the most backward. Like Sheridan, Highland Park and University Park, Texas, contiguous suburbs entirely surrounded by Dallas, got rid of their black children after 1954. The park cities already were sundown suburbs, allowing no independent African-American households. But some of their affluent white families had live-in maids and gardeners. Before the 1954 Supreme Court decision, children of these adults were quietly allowed to attend black schools in Dallas, with tuition paid by Highland Park and University Park. After Brown, Park City's officials realized they'd be vulnerable to a desegregation lawsuit. Alderman C.K. Bullard suggested that Park City's residents, who employed African Americans with children, be asked to fire them, so that Park City's would not be confronted with white and Negro children attending classes together. Most African American families moved out by the late 1950s. Dallas didn't actually stop accepting black students from the suburbs until 1961. At least one African American servant with children still lived in Highland Park at that point, so her employer, a rich white family, paid rent on a Dallas address for her so that her children could stay in school in Dallas while living with her at their house in Park Cities. Even before Brown, whites in many locales were upset with having to pay taxes to support separate schools for African-American children. Sometimes they responded by driving black families from their communities. In Case Township, north of Norman, Oklahoma, for example, residents grew alarmed because two white landowners hired three or four black families to farm their land. One resident, who signed himself a hoodlum, wrote to the Norman newspapers, "Farmers of Case Township are as just much against mixing up with niggers as the good people of Norman are, and what is more, they don't intend to have their farms taxed to put up Negro schoolhouses." Eventually, the whites burned down one black family's house, but may not have succeeded in driving all the African Americans away. I suspect similar reasoning led to anti-black actions in Arkansas, Kentucky, Missouri, and Tennessee. Around the time of the Brown decision, the African American population of at least five counties in Kentucky and Tennessee fell precipitously. Perhaps the black families in these counties moved away voluntarily, but the example of Sheridan raises suspicion. Historian Mary Walks has done research on one of the five, Polk County, Tennessee, which abuts North Carolina on the Appalachian Mountains. According to one account, she writes, Brown prompted whites there to force black families to sell their farms, in an effort to rid the county of schoolchildren who would have to be integrated into the Polk County system. The number of African Americans in Polk County, which had been 566 in 1890, fell from 75 in 1950 to just 28 10 years later, and only 4 of school age, among 12,160 inhabitants. Across America, many whites in sundown counties felt blessed to have no black children in 1954. As Esther Sanderson put it in 1974, Scott County, Tennessee, definitely has no segregation problem, for there is not a single Negro living in the entire county. Some other communities in Arkansas, Kentucky, Missouri, and Tennessee may also have gotten rid of their African Americans after Brown, as white families reacted to the possibility that, unless the few black families in town could be induced to leave, their children might wind up in our school. Other catalysts. Every sundown town, especially those that expel their African Americans violently, has its own answer as to why it went all white. Residents of sundown towns and suburbs rarely refer to the increased racism of the nadir or to such social and cultural factors as politics, ethnic composition, or labor history. Instead, residents explain their town's policy by telling about the incident that triggered it. We must not accept these trigger stories at face value. Sometimes there are competing accounts, and often they're after-the-fact rationalizations, detailing acts that may or may not have taken place. Even where an account of the beginning of a town's sundown policies is accurate, leaving it as the actual cause of its continuing exclusion is far too simple. The events that triggered mass expulsions were often instances of black misbehavior. Some African American did something wrong, and whites responded by taking it out on the entire group. Such was the case in Anna, Illinois, in 1909. The convenience store clerk quoted at the beginning of this book, who confirmed in 2001 the continuing nickname for Anna, Ain't No Niggers Allowed, also related Anna's explanation for its policy. My girlfriend told me how that all got started. A black man raped a white girl, and she's buried up in the cemetery with a memorial stone, and they hung him. Her girlfriend is right. Residents of Anna do date its sundown status to 1909. On November 8th of that year, Anna Pelley, a 24-year-old white woman, was murdered in Cairo, some 30 miles south. She was found in an alley near her home the next morning, gagged and strangled, her clothing ripped off. Bloodhounds led police to a black-owned house where they later arrested Will James, a delivery man for the Cairo Coal and Ice Company. That evening, a lynch mob gathered in Cairo, but the police chief quieted them by pointing out that the police weren't sure they had the right man. After all, the evidence against James consisted mostly of the fact that bloodhounds had sniffed their way to his house, as a contemporary newspaper account put it. The following Friday, November 11th, rumors that James had confessed caused whites again to threaten a lynch mob. The sheriff, Frank Davis, decided to get his prisoner out of Cairo. That evening, the sheriff, a deputy, and James boarded the northbound Illinois Central train to escape the lynch mob. But Whites and Caro telephoned news of Davis's flight to Anna, 30 miles north, Anna Pelley's hometown, where another mob assembled to await his arrival. "It wouldn't do to stay on the train and try to get through Anna with him," the sheriff later explained. "That was the former home of the girl he was accused of killing, and I knew that the news that we were coming would be telephoned and telegraphed to Anna in time for her friends to collect a mob at the depot that would take him from me. So I had the train stopped at Dongola, 10 miles south, and we struck out in the darkness across the county eastward." The mob now combed the woods around Dongola. Eventually, walking through the night, the prisoner and his guards reached the little town of Karnak, where Sheriff Davis bought sardines, crackers, and soft drinks for the three of them. They didn't dare stay in Karnak, however, lest they be recognized, so they walked on toward Belknap. There they hoped to catch a 5 p.m. northbound train on a different railroad and evade Anna and the mob altogether. Unfortunately, a train crew at Karnak had recognized them and relayed their whereabouts back to Caro. "When we discovered late in the afternoon that a mob was tailing us," in the sheriff's words, "we traveled as fast as we could in the hope of keeping ahead until dark. But the pursuers closed in on us, and when we found that we were in greater danger of being seen if we kept on than if we hid where we were, we concealed ourselves in the bushes and waited, hoping that they'd pass us by. But they found us." The mob overpowered the prisoner and his guards and forced them onto a southbound train at Karnak. Word of the capture preceded them. When they reached Caro, thousands of people, many from Anna and other nearby towns, gathered to watch at the main downtown intersection, spanned by a double ornamental steel arch festooned with hundreds of bright lights. A reporter described the scene. "The mob that hanged James was led by women, many of them the wives of influential residents of Caro. The rope was pulled taut by female relatives of Miss Pelley, aided by several score of their sex. As the Negro was pulled up into the air, these same women sang and screamed in delight. The men were for the most part spectators until the rope that was strangling the Negro broke and his dying body fell to the ground. Then hundreds of revolvers flashed and 500 bullets crashed into the quivery form of the Negro. The riddled dead man was then dragged through the principal streets of the city to the spot where the Pelley girl was assaulted and slain. Women applied the torch to the bonfire that had been prepared and into which the body of James was thrown. 10,000 cheered and danced at the scene." Interestingly, this became an equal opportunity lynching, for the crowd later grabbed another prisoner from the jail, a white photographer accused of killing his wife the previous summer, and hanged him from a telegraph pole at a different downtown location. When the mob members from Anna returned home on a later Illinois Central train, they decided to drive all African Americans from the town, primarily some 30 or 40 men who worked at a local quarry, along with their families. To the best of my knowledge, Anna has been all white ever since. So has its twin city, Jonesboro. According to oral tradition, one old lady who had been a slave was allowed to stay when the other blacks were driven out. Few whites displayed any remorse or even embarrassment at the expulsion of African Americans from Anna Jonesboro. Most residents of Anna felt they had improved their town by the act. Some residents of surrounding towns were jealous. For that matter, most whites were not appalled even by the lynchings. Before burning the body of Will James, members of the mob cut out his heart. Then they cut it up and carried the pieces away for souvenirs. Afterward, James's half-burned head was displayed on top of a pole in a Carroll park, and photographers sold postcards of his hanging. Ministers justified both lynchings from the pulpit. The Carbondale Free Press reprinted with approval an editorial in the Carroll Bulletin in memory of Miss Pelley, suggesting that on November 10th of each year, every Carroll man wear a small knot of rope in the lapel of his coat as a quiet and dignified manifestation of the end of evildoers of any and all races who outrage or insult pure womanhood. Every white and colored man of the city can thus place himself on record for law and order for a day each year. Neither editor saw any irony in using a symbol of a lynching rope as a celebration of law and order. A public subscription was taken up to purchase an extraordinary tombstone for Pelley. Interracial rape as catalyst. Anna's hardly the only community to use rape or murder as an excuse to drive out or keep out all African Americans. Residents of many sundown towns explain their community's all-white status by invoking incidents that embody the familiar African-American-as-problem ideology, but with specific local details about what blacks did wrong here. Ever since, to justify the continued vigilance, and sometimes brutal actions required to maintain a town or suburb as an all-white community, whites summon up the long-ago alleged misbehavior of the victim class. Interracial rape was the excuse for the 1912 expulsion of African Americans from Forsyth County, Georgia, for example. On September 10th of that year, alleged rapist Edward Collins, an African-American, was shot in the Forsyth County jail by a lynch mob. Several other African-Americans, allegedly his accomplices, were threatened with lynching, but officers spirited them to Atlanta for safety. The mob then turned upon the African-American community. Between September 10th and the end of that year, according to the Forsyth County historian, notices were given to all the Negro population to leave the county. A few persisted in staying and were promised protection by their landlords. A few houses were dynamited and burned, and then the whites were notified to get rid of their Negro tenants or have their houses and barns likewise burned. This accomplished the removal of the rest of the blacks. The African-American population in Forsyth County plummeted from 1,100 in 1910 to 30 in 1920 and 17 in 1930. Many other expulsions and attempted expulsions followed allegations of interracial rape. The 1908 riot that swept Springfield, Illinois, for example, began after Mabel Hallam, a white woman, claimed that George Robinson, a black man, had raped her. The black community was driven out of Pinckneyville, Illinois, in about 1928. One explanation extant in Pinckneyville today states that a black man raped a white woman, so the whites got a bus, loaded all the blacks on it, and took them to East St. Louis. Unconfirmed oral history in La Salle, Peru, twin cities in northeastern Illinois, holds that they've been all white since the lynching of a black man who raped an Irish-American woman. Black crime waves as catalyst. If not rape, Often, sundown towns and counties invented black crime waves by African Americans to explain why they drove out their black populations. When Green Saunders referred to the second killing of white people by Negroes as the reason for driving all African Americans from Comanche County, Texas, he was conflating two very different African American criminals, 8 years apart, to create a menace. In about 1878, Mose Jones, an old ex-slave, had been living with his wife, child, and stepdaughter on the T.J. Neighbors farm. According to Eulalia Wells, Mose did the morning chores about the kitchen and also worked at the stable. Mose was apparently one of the most humble of Negroes in town. It was characteristic of him that when he met white people, he at once held his hat against his breast and bowed and spoke with deep humility. But after his wife died, old Mose snapped. First, he tried to marry his 14-year-old stepdaughter. He then killed the stepdaughter, his own daughter, and the neighbor's two young boys. And but for Mrs. Neighbors being a light sleeper, would have murdered her and her husband. He set fire to the house and fled. By daybreak, about 200 men were searching for Mose, Wells goes on. He was found about 6 miles east of town on the other side of Indian Creek and was shot. Wells then writes a telling paragraph. Everyone thought that old Mose was the only mean Negro in town, so the others were allowed to remain. The Negroes kept coming into the county during the next few years, and soon a large settlement of them located in the northeastern part of the county. To her, writing in 1942, it's natural that whites would have the right to decide whether African Americans as a group will be allowed to remain after this one event by an obviously deranged man. And after one more interracial crime, 8 years later, Comanche County whites snapped. To garner support for the 1895 Spring Valley, Illinois massacre described in the previous chapter, Italian-American miners blamed African-Americans for every crime committed in the area, in Felix Armfield's words. Your American whites in the town soon sided with the Italian cause. A Tennessee County historian tells of a similar expulsion based on a wave of thefts and arson, but admits that the crimes continued after the African Americans had been driven out. Whites in Wyandotte, Michigan, drove out their African American residents repeatedly, most prominently in 1916. Wyandotte residents, treating the 1916 expulsion in the 1940s, tried to blame the victims. Negroes in 1916 era were very low type, ran houses of ill repute, attacked Wyandotte women and children, a real threat to law-abiding citizens. But according to Edwina DeWint, compiler of Wyandotte History, Negro, African Americans posed no threat. City records from the time show no record of white protests about their behavior. Surely the vaguest crime wave of all took place in Chesterton, Indiana, described by the newspaper editor at the head of this chapter. All kinds of depredations were going on. Catalysts do not explain. Explanations that blame the origin of sundown policies on criminal characteristics of the excluded group contain two obvious fallacies: collective guilt and circular reasoning. The events described in the Chesterton newspaper neatly exemplify both. when one or more African Americans commit crimes, the entire group is considered responsible and should be punished. And once blacks were gone, since Chesterton subsequently had no major crimes, the paper's editor knows that the town's policy saved this county many a tragedy. So the townspeople were right to have gotten rid of them. Similarly, once Anna expelled its blacks, it had no more black murderers, even though it never had any to start with, the murder having taken place elsewhere. The explanation thus provides continuing justification for a town's continuing policy of excluding African Americans. These crimes, or alleged crimes, do not really reveal why a town or county drove out its black population. Partly because, when a European American committed a similar crime, whites as a group faced no similar repercussions. Moreover, often the catalysts don't hold up even as triggers. The attempted rape and murder of Anna Pelley, followed by the lynching of Will James, don't really explain why Anna Jonesboro went sundown, for example. For one thing, James may have been innocent. Sheriff Davis thought so. I questioned him a great deal while we were in the woods together, and he insisted all the time that he was innocent. I am very much in doubt whether he is the guilty man or not. Moreover, both the murder and the lynching took place 30 miles away, not even in the same county. In Forsyth County, the mob did apparently get the right person, for the white victim identified three African Americans as the perpetrators, one of whom was lynched, the other two convicted. Even so, interracial rape can't have been the real cause for the subsequent eviction of the entire black population of the county, because Forsyth was one of six adjacent counties in North Georgia that expelled their African Americans at about this time. Indeed, Forsyth was probably the third to do so after Towns and Union counties, and I know no claims of black rape or murder as the catalyst for those expulsions. Whites in Dawson County, between Forsyth and Union, expelled their African Americans about when Forsyth did. All were gone by 1920. Parts of Fannin and Gilmer counties, just west of Union, also went sundown at this time. No claims of rape were ever made, so far as I know, to justify the expulsions of African Americans from Dawson, Fannin, and Gilmer counties. Surely contagious rioting in the white communities, Towns County did it, why haven't we, is more likely than any undocumented epidemic of African Americans raping whites in county after contiguous county. We can't conclude that interracial rape was really the cause of the attempted expulsion of African Americans from Springfield either, because it turns out there'd been no rape. Mabel Hallam dropped all charges against George Robinson. Eventually, she confessed that she'd had sex with her white lover and had invented the black rapist story to escape blame from her husband and friends. The Pinckneyville rape story is thoroughly vague and conflicts with accounts offered by others in the town. The alleged rape in La Salle, Peru is even vaguer, including no date or names, and implies the towns had a black population that whites then drove off in the aftermath of a crime. Either the crime took place before the Civil War, or the rise and fall of such population would have to have been rapid and intersensal, since La Salle and Peru have been all white in every census from 1860 to the recent past. I suspect Both of these sketchy anecdotes are attempts by whites years later to ascribe the sundown policies to origins that seem plausible, but in fact didn't take place. Various catalyst stories were reported to explain and justify the 1907 expulsion of Sikhs from Bellingham, Washington. According to one account, the riot may have started when a gang of young rowdies who were collected on a corner decided to have some fun with the Hindus. Another version held that the Hindus agreed to pay the landlord of a shack in Old Town $15 a month for the place, and as a result, a white woman who was living there was forced to move. It's reported that she's the one who incited the trouble. However, underlying conflict between European American and Sikh workers at lumber mills in the city had been festering for some time, and was surely more important than any trigger.
Context of white supremacy. So we will pick up the next, subsection, vague or mislaid catalyst stories. That's the next subsection that we will pick up on. Number, if you have thoughts, comments you would like to share, new number, whites changed it last week. The new number 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have thoughts, feel free to share. Again, you can drop an email. We have a ways to go before we get to the conclusion. So if you're listening to the archives or if you're listening live and are not able to chime in, you can drop an email and we will read your commentary during the live broadcast. Folks can give a thought. We've had interesting use of terms throughout the text, race relations and what have you. His use of the term invent, when he's talking about the origin myths, I guess that's another one that could be asked, phrasing origin myths. But when he's talking about these explanations, reasons that are being given for why there are no Negroes in a given area, and he says that the whites invent these rationalizations. What do we make of that word choice? Because he invokes it quite a bit, invent. Just one to think on if you have listeners have a thought. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, I'll be heard.
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. To answer your question, the word inventing, that it could be practicing racism there, because actually it's a after the fact explanation. You know, they terrorize black people, and then after the fact, you know, and to cover the criminal elements of it, you know, they do this in a mob and then change the story so that over the years, you know, it become the victim's fault on why he was executed or expunged from an area. But like you said, it's interesting phrases like mono ethic, a non-ethic, multiracial, racial, or an oasis of racial unity, whatever that would be. also, he mentioned Jack Johnson, which would be a cowbell, and whether Jack Johnson won or not against the Great White Hope, whites would still mistreat and terrorize black people and end up running out of town. Thanks. And I like to mention, you know, I wanted to look up what eventually happened to Jack Johnson. I know they locked him up. He was traveling with either his girlfriend or his wife, and he went from state to state. They got him for interstate transportation of a minor, I believe. I didn't get a chance to look it up. But they, you know, that deal was probably close to correct. Jack Johnson, you know, was probably making quite a bit of money for that time. And then he would have been an object of hatred of the whites because he dated white women. They killed an old man because he would not stop coming to their church. That has got to be an example of the religion of white supremacy. The religion of white supremacy trumps any other religion. So the man wanted to come out and worship a white Jesus, you know, because he was more than likely brainwashed going to church anyway. And then they killed the man for attending church. Then the young white girls that saw the young black girl taking water from the spring, and then she ran back and told it that it mentioned that the black girl was, I believe, 8 years old. So you can assume the little white girls were similar in that age group, but they already understood what it means to be white. They were not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. You know, at least he kind of came up with the truth when he was saying that, you know, all these convoluted excuses on why they would run blacks out of the area. But then when he brought up that, okay, after the black people run out of the area, they got land and valuables, what happened to that? Whites steal that. So a lot of those motivations probably were, you know, just to steal the land and steal the valuables that the black people had. And then they create an excuse on why they did it later. And last but not least, I believe, yeah, the white women who hanged Willie, Will James, hoisting him up, the white women themselves did it. And they cheered and sang while they did it. And I guess he was saying the white male racists then riddled his body with bullets. You know, I've noticed too that from the beginning of the book, when he talked about Anna, he's given a little bit more of the information as we go further along in the book. So we remember Anna for Ain't No Niggas Allowed, and then the story about the white woman that was raped. You know, I believe that was made up, and I think that the sheriff probably, just to me, it's like he turned the guy in. You know, he made it look like, I mean, if you're traveling up and down the state, you know, word spread. All the white people that saw it was telling all the other ones. It was like a networking. And then he just gave in, and they got the black man. But the lying white women should have been, and even today, should be prosecuted, criminally prosecuted. That old adage about a black man raping a white woman should be old by now. I'll mute my line. Gus, thanks for taking the call.
I guess if I could get 30 seconds, Mr. Dermy, for folks who say, now, wait a minute now, this is a white man, sheriff, running all up and down the back roads, trains, swamps with a Negro, all this. I mean, if he was really just, you know, a no-count racist, he could have, you know, skipped all that. Because, hey, you know, I stumbled. I'm tired. You know, I just don't have the energy. I got to, you know, got things to do. Sorry, Negro, I'm going to have to give you up this time. You know, make your peace. He could have just done that, and we could have skipped all that, you know, jumping trains and such. What would your response to that be?
Okay. My response would be, first of all, if you are the law, so to speak, you know, you have all this, authority behind you. He could have called it, you know, the federal agency. He could have asked for help from local counties. He could have done whatever. The sheriff running? Come on, man. That's a stretch right there. You know, and then conveniently the sheriff is out there hiding in the woods. You know, and the mob finds him. I don't think it's believable, but, you know, it could be. I could be wrong.
Don't think it's believable. The sheriff hiding in the bushes with a Negro. Much obliged, Mr. Dimry Four. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments to share or questions, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard? Okay.
Let's see. Ivy, we'll get you first, then we'll nab retired firefighter.
Okay. Thank you both. Greetings, Dust, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Your question in terms of the term invent, it's actually, I think it's accurate, where, you know, when they practice racism, they always, you know, invent excuses to preserve their reputation. At the same time, he could also be practicing racism just by resisting saying lie about, like you were talking about earlier with the term myth. It stood out that he mentioned, excuse me, that the races that they attacked successful people, they really, and how he was talking about how they resent when black people are successful. I think that's why a lot of times they ask income-related questions. Like, they ask you if you have a job and what type of work do you do and things like that. I've been grilled like that so many times because they want to see, you know, like, what kind of money you're working with. And they do. They definitely have this consistent pattern of resenting that. Where they'll find out that you have a nice car or something like that, and they'll fire you right after, and after they find out. The book also reminded me that, you know, so many names for us have been added. It was like nigger, then Negro, then black, then African-American. It's just so many names. And we still have all those names, like none of them have disappeared, but they just constantly keep being added, where whites have only been called white, and that's it. Thinking about his just ridiculous and racist terms, he used the term racially progressive. Like Mr. Fuller always says, race is racism, so we don't want racially progressive. And on top of that, we don't want progress, we want justice. It stood out to me as well that the women, they led the white females, they led the lynch mob, and they're always, or I'll say usually, at the forefront of black men being harmed. There are certainly no victims of patriarchy and just these people that are just passively obeying white males to harm black people. And I noticed how the author, he referred to the man that was lynched. I can't remember his name, but I believe James was part of it. don't know if he said Will James or something like that, but he kept referring to him as the Negro. And he said something about several bullets crashed into the Negro. And I thought that that was very demeaning. And that was it. I mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus. And thanks to the retired firefighter for letting me go first as well. I mute my line.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Thanks for your patience, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I think Mr. Demery Ford asked a question about heavyweight champion of the world, Jack Johnson. I believe he was speaking about what happened to him. Well, if he's speaking about his demise, it reminds me of what you alert and or warn the listeners every program about the risks one takes in their automobiles. Mr. Johnson liked vehicles, liked cars. He had several cars. He liked to see how fast they would go. And I put it that way to state that he may have been racing against somebody else, but at the same time, some people just like to see how fast their vehicles, how proficient they are as far as speed and power is concerned. And from my readings, Mr. Johnson had that pursuit, and it eventually, over time, created his demise. He was killed in an automobile accident. Event in the context that was spoken about in the readings, the word event. I would say, based on this global system of racial white supremacy, when you connect that with white people, I would say it's a means to arrange untruths for their best interests, for white people's best interests. I would say that would be my meaning for that particular word in that context, because it seemed as though it's accurate every time you hear that word connected with some sort of experience that takes place, that they can come up with some sort of excuse. And that excuse was not based on things that were true. I've also heard that the best lies have some truth in it. And as sometimes they go about that means by having some truth in it, then in some cases they just don't care. They just would just, as the old folks say, would bold face lie. Just everybody, including themselves, know it's not true. And that still goes on today. I mean, white people have not changed at all. I've been finding that out over most of my lifetime, that they have not changed at all since the establishment of the system of racial white supremacy. One just has to have an understanding of their history to be able to dictate that to another victim. Or to a white person that pretends that they have changed, and they haven't. If anything, what they have done different is become more refined, more proficient at their incorrect behavior and or injustice. And the book is describing that. It may be a situation to whereas it may have been some competition. White people have competed with one another on the best means and ways to practice racist white supremacy. And so some of the language that they may use, it may be for that reason on why they make up elaborate, you know, go from just bold-faced lying to some elaborate form of deception, because they want to be able to have, I think Mr. Demery Ford mentioned, they want to be able to have in history in stating some sort of excuse, not so much about to be able to persuade non-white people, but other white people, that sort of thing. That's my report on the first reading so far. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks, if you have comments, questions, feel free, dial in before we get to the second audio segment. Folks wrote in as well. One of our listeners wrote in. He has numbered comments. Number one, I recently viewed a documentary by Dr. Henry Louis Gates. I think that's a cowbell. On the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, he referred to the period after the end of Reconstruction as the nadir of race relations. I wonder if this is a term that white historians have coined in order to minimize the atrocities of the period. Yes, sir. Number two, I am still trying to process the tone of this book as well as the audiobook narrator. My first impression of the tone of the book is that in spite of it being filled with page after page of atrocities and horrors, the tone of both the author and the audiobook may be characterized as dispassionate or unemotional. Number three, one of the few times the author describes what is being perpetrated as terrorist actions when describing the murder of John Williams, a black farmer who was murdered in Washington County, Indiana in 1864, I think that even using the phrase terrorist actions as opposed to naming the perpetrators as terrorists may also be a method of diminishing the depravity of these events. Number four, in discussing the response of whites to the Supreme Court judgment, Brown v. Board of Education. Yes, ma'am.
Because your line is breaking up, like, really bad. I don't know if it's just me.
All right. So let's see. Any better, or is it still not coming through clearly?
That's better. Not 100%, but that's a lot better.
Sounds better.
Not sure. Just context of white supremacy, audio check. Still, is at least am I being heard?
Yes, that's much better.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All righty. Much obliged. Thank you all for letting me know. I'll go back and reread the last one. So number four, in discussing the response of whites to the Supreme Court judgment, the author described the efforts of suspected racists in far north Topeka, Kansas, Washington, D.C., and southern Illinois, struggled to comply with whites in the deep south towns, struggled not to comply. This passage somewhat reminded me of the deeply pained phrase used by Ta-Nehisi Coates and much referenced by Gus. I don't think describing the acts of racism, white supremacy committed by racist man and racist woman as a struggle is accurate. That word struggle gets used in interesting ways as well. Number five, the suburbs of Dallas, Texas, Highland Park and University Park were so dedicated to maintaining white supremacy that they asked residents, employed African Americans, to fire them in order to avoid a potential lawsuit from the anticipated Brown v. Board of Education decision if they continue to quote unquote segregate black children. Number six, the section describing the actions of white women during the lynching of Will James at Cairo, Illinois, suggested that the female participants derived some type of bizarre, sadistic, possibly sexualized pleasure from the torture of this black male. The mob that hanged James was led by women, many of them wives of influential residents of Cairo. These same women sang and screamed in delight. Women applied the torch. 10,000 danced and cheered at the scene. This was one of the more disturbing sections thus far in the text. Listener has a few more comments. I'll sprinkle those in as we proceed. Make sure I get to some of my notes as well. Again, if you have other comments on this portion of the reading, you should go ahead and get a hand up. We have about 20 minutes before we get to the next 25 minutes before we get to the next audio segment. Some of the notes that I took on this section, we're at the beginning of chapter 7 today. I thought it was so telling that they went to the school building to organize their purge of black people. That was the one that he started with at the beginning of the chapter, Catalysts and Origin Myths. And then next, he said it really didn't take much of anything for them to begin purging Negroes. It could be an incendiary remark by a demagogic white politician, Ben Tillman, Donald Trump. Let's see, next. The passage where he says in most towns that had African Americans and then had none, some account of this triggering event persists in local culture to explain their absence. This story then gets raised to the level of myth and becomes used not only as the sole reason for the original expulsion, but also to justify the town's continuing exclusion of African Americans. Story, myth, invention. In my view, it's extraordinarily important that this not be something that gets pussyfooted, that it's emphatic, because the primary method of white supremacy racism is deception. That seems to be a core element of this book. White people, the violence, deception. You commit these purges, you kill the black people, you steal their property, their valuables, whatever it is, you kick them out of the area, and then you lie about it. You get some distance. You brag about it at first. He's mentioned that a lot too. Brag about not having niggers here. You might put your signs up and this becomes a selling point for the town. But eventually the refinement kicks in and it's okay. We bragged for the last 20 years about, you know, not having any niggers. And, you know, we had souvenirs of the niggers we killed and raped and stole their land and all that. All right. We'll have to confine that to closed doors. At least publicly, we will say that the niggers raped a white woman. We'll go with that one. No. What about the niggers, they were stealing. Yes, we'll go with that one. They were drunk. You heard it at the beginning. They were drunk at the railroad. They got all that money. They were gambling. We'll go with that one. Shooting niggers, that one always works. We got shooting niggers. We'll go with that. Or he raped a white woman, or both. They just make up things. White people lie about the practice of racism all the time. That is so important, and that gets greatly minimized. Really, in my view, that's one of the major, major ways that Mr. Lowen is practicing racism throughout this text. Next. Yeah, I think Mr. Demery Ford mentioned the metaphor, the town stayed interracial, whatever that means. Mr. Fuller suggests not using that word. The minds stayed organized, and Duquan has long been an oasis of racial tolerance. What does that even mean? You talked about race relations, racial tolerance, the metaphors again. Are we talking about a pool, black people and white people in some sort of pool of water together? What are you talking about? And they elected a black alderman. Whoopee. Next, let's see. I think we had a listener a week or so back. We started out saying that they wanted to pay attention to see if there are examples of black people fighting back in the text, if it's just going to be a wave of whites terrorizing black people and there's no fighting back, no resistance from the victims. Where he's talking about here, this is 1989 in Illinois. Suddenly, one of the Negroes drew a pistol and fired at the group of white pursuers. The miners answered with a volley. Several of the Negroes fell. The others ran for their lives. And there were several incidents in this week of black people not just being the victims of violence, but engaging in self-defense. That was something we're supposed to be paying attention to as we read. Let's see. Next. Slocum, Texas. We 2000 podcasts, Cows Decade, our 10-year anniversary. E.R. Bills was a guest on our program, I believe, summer of 2014, massacre in Slocum, Texas. We talked about that event. Incidentally, he lives in Texas, and we had a black female who's one of the ancestors of one of the black victims in Slocum. He talked about that event, and from my memory, he did not have a conclusion about what prompted this event. I remember we spent the first portion of the program talking about the genesis, the trigger, if you will, for the Slocum massacre, and he didn't have a conclusion. Now, this book is more recent than Sundown Towns, but Jack Johnson could have been. There was a labor dispute. There were lots of different reasons given, but there wasn't a clear explanation. There wasn't a clear reason as to why the event in Slocum took place, but it was the same type of trend. You can go back in the archives and listen to that broadcast if you want to get more details about that one. Next. Let's see. I thought it was important as well, and it seems that he is quoting black people. That was another one we were supposed to be paying attention to. He quoted from the Chicago Defender, a famous black publication, Margaret Ferguson. I think I've been trying to mention black people that black authors, black sources that are being referenced. So it seems that he is quoting from black sources. But I thought the section he is quoting Margaret Ferguson, a black female, and she was talking about how whites would target black people who may have been a little bit more well off, have been doing better for themselves. And this is a common theme. Ida B. Wells Barnett talked about this as well, that she too had been conditioned to think that a black person maybe had engaged in some misbehavior or some crime of some sort to deserve being lynched or punished. But then as she became less confused, she understood that that was not the case, that white people just lied and practiced racism. And she too also noted that, oh, wow, it does seem like they're going after black business owners and black people who are doing well, maybe trying to vote. Are they owning property? That sort of thing. It seems like they're attacking them deliberately. Let's see. Next. Quite a bit of this, the man knot, race, class, genre, and dilemmas of black manhood, Dr. Curry, where in Lexington, it says, according to the Oklahoma News, Negro men were tied up and beaten. Negro women outraged. Now, I don't know what that means. Negro women outraged. That could have meant they were raped. I don't know. Outraged is kind of vague. He talked about that. So, but I mean, I don't have any confusion about Negro men tied up and beaten. I know what that means. And it seems like that is a pattern where this violence is directed at black males frequently in these acts. I thought this was really important as well. I think Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. has said consistently, I have echoed over the years, whites cannot be ignorant about racism. You will get in trouble with other white people. Exhibit A, the great state of Florida, Sunshine State. The Grandmaster Florida Ku Klux sends a letter to Judge John Cheney, who has been a little too helpful to the Negros. And he was a Republican. So they send him a letter and let him know, you are familiar with how we get down and blah, blah, blah. And they let him know. They get to the end and they say, now, look here. If you are a scholar, you know that history repeats itself and that he who resorts to your kind of game is handling edged tools. We shall always enjoy white supremacy, and white supremacy is spelled in all capital letters. We shall always enjoy white supremacy in this country, and he who interferes must face the consequences. This is all quoted. Again, this is quoted from a notice sent to Judge Cheney. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. Not even going to say racism, because that's not what they said. They said white supremacy with all capital letters. I generally do not spell it with all capitals, but I do capitalize the W and the S. For that reason, this is serious business. And the Voltron effect has been on display so frequently in this section. The train incident that Mr. Demery Ford mentioned, this is way before the era of Twitter, smartphones, social media, 5G, all of that. And whites are relaying information. They got string, can, telegraphs, carrier pigeon, whatever it is. Negra is on the run. Thousands of white people galvanized, lickety split, in an era where communications are poor. They didn't even have railroads completed in some areas, much less a vehicle. It's not like you could get an Uber and, you know, four or five people could pile into a vehicle. You're talking about hoofing it. Maybe you're on a horse, maybe 1,000 people.
Negro on the run. We got to get him. Get the sheriff, too, if he messes around. Let's see. Next, Chicago defender I mentioned. When they had the fight over the water, about who was going to get access to the water, and it ended up being some four white girls who stopped a black girl, 8-year-old black girl, from getting water, and this event became the catalyst for purging black people from the town. Just reminded me of Flint and just basic resources in the system of racism, white supremacy. At the end of that section, they said, decades later, according to oral history, Saadi Daisy sported a sign that said, "Niggers fun, look and run." I just thought that was important. One, I would love to have seen that sign too. It says "niggers fun" with the apostrophe on the S. So like, what niggers, what's fun for niggers? Look and run. Don't hang out here. Nothing good gonna happen to you. That's nigger fun. Look and run. Let's see. Next. I too, the caller that wrote in, struggled. I thought it was, in my view, possibly a deliberate act of white supremacy racism for Mr. Lowen to say, make sure I get it, towns as far north as Topeka, Kansas, Washington, D.C., and Southern Illinois struggled to comply with the Brown v. Board of Education. I do not think it's accurate to say that they struggled to comply. I think you had hosts of racists who did not want to comply and or refused to comply. That is the most accurate way. In fact, it's not to say that they struggle to comply when they say every day right now, 2019, and they've been saying this for at least the last 5 years or so, for the 60-year anniversary of Brown v. Board, that we are just as segregated, quote unquote, as we were in 1954. They've made a matter of routine of saying that. That's not that somebody is struggling. That is a matter of whites saying resolutely, we have no interest in having whites in school with niggers, period. And then continuing in that sentence, he says, while whites in the Deep South towns struggled not to comply. That's not accurate either. When you have folks saying massive resistance, that is not struggling not to comply. We just talked about Virginia and the Coon Man. They closed the schools for 5 years. That's not struggling not to comply. That is bold face defiance. White supremacy in all capital letters. Next. Oh my goodness. The one they talked about Dallas again. They said at least one African-American servant with children still lived in Highland Park at that point. So her employer, a rich white family, paid rent on a Dallas address for her so that her children could stay in school in Dallas while living with her at their house in the Park Cities. The lengths whites will go to practice racism, white supremacy. We want nigger help. Stay with us in our house. Stay with your, keep your little nigger children in the house too. But we support white supremacy. We can't have your nigger children invading our schools here, and that could cause a lot of problems. So we'll just pay the extra money so that you can have your nigger children out in Dallas, not out here messing it up with our white children. Just the that is one thing that I greatly appreciate about the text, just the myriad of examples and detail about how white supremacy racism is practiced. Let's see, I'll get in maybe two more. He says, I appreciate this, when Mr. Demery Ford says the story about the sheriff hiding the black male, that he said it didn't sound believable, sounding like a scholar. And Mr. Lowen would say, absolutely right, Mr. Demery Ford, because I'm reading, we must not accept these trigger stories at face value. Sometimes there are competing accounts, and often they are after the fact rationalizations detailing acts that may or may not have taken place. Again, James Lowen, it would be minimal of me to say you're pussyfooting. In my view, you're deliberately practicing racism. Again, this man wrote a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Why can't we just make it plain? You got a lot of whites, racists, who are lying about these events, lying to protect property that they stole, lying to protect black people that they killed, raped, whatever else. Lying. It needs to be articulated as such. Even the sentence, he says, the events that triggered mass expulsions were often instances of black misbehavior, period. That sentence, I thought, was wholly incorrect if we've already said that the so-called invented origin myths can't just be accepted at face value, then we can't just make a blanket statement that say these events often started with incidents of black misbehavior because these reported incidents could be false. A lot of times, these events were disputed. You had a lot of incidents where at least the accused black person said, I didn't do this. We didn't have due process. It's not like we had a trial in a correct, just court of law to get to the facts of whether or not this is even true to even accept this statement. I'm accepting racists who just said, oh, yeah, he raped a white woman. Oh, yeah, the niggas were, you know, out with their razors and cutting and acting a fool. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. Next. Already talked about the train incident. The importance of the white women leading the incident with the killing of Mr. James. I thought that was extremely important. And the sexual component to it, as was pointed out by a listener. The equal opportunity lynching, I thought was important. They lynched this black male and chopped his head off to display it. Jeffrey Dahmer, the savageness of it all cannot be minimized. And then they go and they kill a white person. Just the bloodthirst cannot be satisfied. We got anybody else that we can kill. Enjoyed this one so much. Didn't give any details about the white person being mutilated and the body being saved for souvenirs and that sort of thing. They reserved that for the niggers, it seems. I've also thought it was important. Few whites displayed any remorse or even embarrassment at the expulsion of African Americans from Anna Jonesboro. And this was consistent, not just one place. This is nothing to be embarrassed about or upset about. This is generally something to brag about and commemorate. Let's see. Last comment I'll get, and then we'll see if any of the listeners have a comment they want to get in. Yeah, he has, I guess the last one I'll get in, black crime waves as catalyst. He has crime waves in quotes. If not rape, often sundown towns and counties invented. There's that word again, black crime by waves. By African-Americans to explain, he has explained in quotes, why they drove out their black populations. Again, in my view, it can't just be that you put explain in quotes. It's got to be these folks are lying. It's so clear. It's so over. It would be different if this was maybe a one-time thing, but for this to be so consistent, to have this happen, the preponderance of evidence is so great. It would have to be, make it plain. You've got a lot of whites who are lying, and that is a major component to how white supremacy is practiced in these events. The terrorist act in that moment, and then the ongoing cover-up of this criminal terrorist act by generations of whites who are benefiting from this in multitudes of ways, bragging about it, benefit from it, and then they participate actively, 201 non-active, in covering up and deceiving about what took place with this event, covering up for their relatives so they're not thought of as murderers and rapists and terrorists, all of it. Super important, and I thank James Loewen. Even though it's a lot of great information, that just further solidifies, in my view, even James Loewen practicing dedicated to white supremacy racism because even he is pussyfooting about how he is giving this information. I'll hush there. Do any other folks have comments they wanted to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
When you said about them commemorating just their terrorism, it actually made me think of the lynching museums and things like that, that's probably what those are about rather than, you know, trying to remember the victims or trying to, I guess, make things right from the things that they did and trying to tribute them and things like that. It's probably just an underhanded way to commemorate and celebrate in a real covert way their terrorism. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Ivy. Any other questions, comments folks want to get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Yes, ma'am, I'll be heard.
Mr. Demery Four.
Oh, yes. Well, we don't keep going on and on with this. But another thing came across my mind when the sheriff, you know, got off the train and went into the woods. If you remember the beginning of the story, it was a bloodhound that led them to the guy's house in the first place. So if you get off the train and you're going through the woods, you know, you're easy to track with a bloodhound, even if the story is remotely true. But I would not allow me to talk about that, kind of threw me off. But, oh, I wanted to ask you, when you gave your commentary and you saw where there was, he quoted a black person, where was that in the book?
You said he quoted a black person. Which book did he quote?
No, the when you made the reference to, I think it was somebody in Chicago, an author or whatever, he made reference in a footnote or whatever. I missed that.
Margaret,
we were talking about whether, whether the author was referencing black references or not, black people.
Right. I think the one from this week.
Chicago Defender, yeah.
Yes.
Made that, yeah.
I can even look at my footnotes from this week, maybe, and pull it up.
Well, you can just give it to me later. I mean, you know.
Okay. Is this it? I have it. I think the Chicago Defender is mentioned more than once. Might take me an extra second to nab it, but I'll be sure to get it, because it was a few authors this week that I think could have been black people, or sources that I think were written by black people. So, anywho,
okay, because one instance, he was talking about a black person writing about an incident, but she was black, and she wrote a book that said something about good to be black. But then she called out a black union person as the one who caused the explosion. You know, I mean, a lot of this stuff just don't jive. I mean, it could be true, but it just doesn't sound right. Now, I'll mute my line. Thanks, Scott.
Ruby Goodwin, that's the black female. It's good to be black, where she was talking about the union situation. I think that was from last week. We were talking about her. But yes, she, black female, and she was talking about the strike. I think she said that it was a black person who actually came in and did the shooting that caused the explosion in that situation. I think it was supposed to be mostly black fatalities, but he said in the text that was under dispute. That was another one where that was under dispute, who did it, who were the victims, that sort of thing. But that is one of the black sources that he quotes in the book, Ruby Goodwin, G-O-O-D-W-I-N. And I think you can get that book on Amazon.
Okay, thanks, man.
Yes, sir. We will get to the second audio segment now. That way we'll have ample time once this section concludes. If you have, if you did not get to participate, or if you have additional thoughts or questions, write them down. We should have ample time once we conclude. So we'll pick up this audio segment number 2, James Loewen, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, Context of White Supremacy.
Vague or mislaid catalyst stories. If catalysts don't provide satisfying explanations of why towns keep African Americans from living in them, some accounts of the original expulsion or prohibition have grown so vague over time that they can barely function even as catalysts. Tonawanda and North Tonawanda are located at the western end of the Erie Canal. Many African Americans have lived in the area, especially in Buffalo to the south and Niagara Falls to the north, and blacks always worked on the canal boats. Such centrally located towns couldn't have been all white for decades by accident. As late as 1990, Tonawanda had just 28 African Americans among 17,284 people, while North Tonawanda had 56 among 35,000. It turns out that both were sundown towns. Law professor Bill Kaplan grew up there in the 1940s and 50s and learned only that some black man allegedly did something bad long ago. Whites then drove out all African Americans and forbade them to live there after that. Kathy Spillman, who grew up in North Tonawanda two decades later, couldn't recall even that much, although she knew the towns kept out African Americans. Some old-timers in the Tonawandas may remember when and how African Americans were forced out, but it's not a living memory shared by the community as a whole. Sometimes alternative catalyst stories compete. On Halloween night, 1919, whites in Corbin, Kentucky, a railroad town of about 3,400, forced their African Americans out of town after two white switchmen lost all their money in a poker game with black track layers. To cover their losses, the switchmen said African Americans had robbed them. A mob formed and searched the city for Negroes, according to the account in the Lexington Herald. The Negroes, who felt the fury of the mob in the greatest degree, were a gang of about 200 Negroes working on the Louisville and Nashville grade for 10 months at South Corbin, where the railroad company is making big improvements. Crowds went to restaurants and other public places, caught all the Negro employees they could, and drove them, singly or in gangs, at the point of guns to the depot. Many Negroes were beaten, and 200 were driven out of town. At gunpoint, whites then forced almost the entire African-American population onto railroad cars and shipped them to Knoxville, Tennessee. But residents of Corbin haven't found this origin story satisfying over the years, so they make up new ones. One woman volunteered that four black men were lynched for attacking a white woman. One man, interviewed for Robbie Heason's gripping 1990 documentary about Corbin as a sundown town, said that he really didn't know what to believe for sure because, "I've heard that story 100 times since I've been in Corbin, and it's been told to me about 100 different ways. Usually, even such vague or conflicting accounts still suffice as catalyst stories, because they make reference to black misbehavior. Implicitly, most African Americans are thought to share this characteristic, which is why we must exclude them. However, residents of some sundown towns have completely forgotten why they ever expelled African Americans. In 2002, residents of Crossville, Tennessee, knew theirs was a sundown county and had had a black population until about 1905, but they'd lost any oral tradition to explain exactly how and why their African Americans were forced out. Other communities have even forgotten that they ever had any African Americans, let alone that they expelled them. Many suburbs display this amnesia, especially those that reopened to blacks more than a decade ago. Chamblee, Georgia, for example, has experienced such international and diverse immigration as a booming suburb of Atlanta that only 1/3 of its residents in 2000 were born in the United States. Still fewer were born in Georgia, and only a handful in Chamblee. The result is that today's residents have no memory that Chamblee became a sundown town after World War II and was all white in 1970, let alone why. For at least 2 decades, Chamblee has been thoroughly multiracial and multiethnic, so the town has no reason to maintain an account of why it is, or was, all white. Contagion as catalyst. Some towns went sundown simply because a neighboring town did so. The neighboring event served as a catalyst of sorts, but actually it shows the absence of a catalyst. The only cause required to set off an expulsion seemed to be envy of a neighboring town that had already driven out its African Americans. In southwestern Missouri, for instance, newspaper editor Murray Bischoff believes that Monette's prosperity, after it threw out all its African Americans in 1894, likely contributed to Pierce City's copycat riot 7 years later. Bischoff thinks Pierce City, in turn, became a model for other nearby towns in Missouri and Arkansas. After whites expelled African Americans from Corbin, Kentucky in 1919, a copycat mob rioted a few months later in Ravenna, 70 miles north, and forced Ravenna's black railroad workers out. Ravenna remained all white into the 1990s. As we saw with Anna, a lynching in one town might trigger an expulsion in another. Lynchings typically inflamed white opinion, not against the crime, but against the victim class. And often, this animus crossed state lines. After the 1931 lynching of Raymond Gunn in Maryville in northwest Missouri, white passions were inflamed in small towns in northeastern Kansas, more than 50 miles distant. In 1920, a huge mob hanged three African-American circus workers in Duluth, Minnesota, believing they had raped Irene Tuscan, a white woman. In reality, whether she was raped by anyone is doubtful. Nevertheless, in the aftermath, the acting chief of police of neighboring Superior, Wisconsin, declared, "We're going to run all idle Negroes out of Superior, and they're going to stay out." His decree was hardly limited to idle Negroes. All African Americans employed by a carnival in Superior were fired and told to leave the city, even though they were working. And the overall black population of Superior tumbled from 169 in 1920 to just 51 10 years later. Such edicts again showed black communities balanced on a knife edge, for no one even bothered to claim that its members did anything to provoke retribution here. Sometimes epidemics of expulsions or sundown ordinances washed like a wave across entire subregions. In 1886, for example, after whites rioted and drove out African Americans from Comanche County, Texas, nearby residents picked up on the idea. So a broad area of about 3,000 square miles in north-central Texas drove out their African Americans at this time, including all or part of at least four counties. No grievous crime of rape or murder was alleged in those counties to provide a catalyst or excuse. The expulsions were merely copycat actions. We've seen that whites rioted and drove out African Americans from county after county in northern Arkansas and southwestern Missouri around 1900, and in northern Georgia around 1910. I suggest that future investigations may unearth similar epidemics wherever a chain of all-white towns or counties nestles nearby. If rioting was contagious, so too were quieter methods of achieving sundown status, I believe. These days, municipalities deliberately copy each other's ordinances on many topics, rather than inventing them from scratch. I suspect municipalities copied each other's ordinances in the past as well. If Monticello, the seat of Piatt County, Illinois, passed a sundown ordinance, which an attorney there says it did, then trustees of DeLand, a smaller town in Piatt County, would want to keep up with the times, and did, according to its officials, and so on across the Midwest and the nation. I must admit, however, that while the foregoing seems logical to me, it's entirely speculative. The contagion of exclusion was even more pronounced in the suburbs, when one suburb deemed to be prestigious was all white on purpose. It became the thing to do, and other suburbs hastened to emulate the leader. Soon, almost all of the suburbs around a major city kept out African Americans. Catalyst stories as origin myths. Although catalysts don't really explain much, they remain important stories nevertheless. Even today, residents of Anna, for instance, cite the story of Anna Pally's death to explain why their town has no African-American residents. Many residents of sundown towns give similar explanations. They admit openly that their town excludes African-Americans and proceed to tell why, relying on the catalyzing incident to justify the practice. Thus, the story of the initial incident gets elevated into an origin myth. Origin myths tell us why we're here as a people, or why we're the way we are. Often they tell us how to be, how to behave, and that we are right, even God's chosen people. The Anna myth still functions in these ways, thus helping to keep its sundown policy alive. As late as the 1970s, signs on Route 127 warned, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Anna Jonesboro." And Anna and Jonesboro still appear to have no black households. The memory of the rape that triggered the 1912 expulsion from Forsyth County was similarly functioning as an origin myth at least as late as 1987. On January 17th of that year, civil rights leaders from Atlanta marched in the county seat of Forsyth to prove that African Americans had a right to be in the county. They failed. A crowd of more than 500, vastly outnumbering the police officers on hand, pelted the marchers with rocks and bottles. A week later, the civil rights forces numbered 20,000, the counter-demonstrators 1,000. 3,000 police and National Guard members maintained order, and the marchers finished their route. Oprah Winfrey broadcast a live TV show from Forsyth County later in the year. She found the origin myth still very much alive in the minds of some of the residents who attended. One woman said, "I've been here all my life. I have. My family goes back 4 generations. And I have a fear of black. I did have a fear of black people. And the only reason was because the girl that got killed back in 1912 is related to me." The incident was still current, still troubling this woman 75 years later. Another member of the audience brought the fear of African Americans to the present in a more general form. "If niggers come in here, it's going to be like Decatur, Georgia, DeKalb County, Fulton County, Atlanta. It's going to be nothing but a slum area." In some sundown towns, the origin myth has become coupled with an object or location that keeps it salient today. To this day, adolescents in Anna go in groups to pay their respects to Anna Pelley's tombstone, a sort of rite of passage that keeps vivid and justifies Anna's all-white nature to the next generation. Other towns have hanging trees that remind residents what happened to the last African American who wandered within the city limits. Smoky Crabtree, a longtime resident of Folk, a sundown town in western Arkansas, used a lighthearted tone in 2001 to convey his amusement at folks' sundown policy and the symbol that helps to maintain it. As far back as the late 20s, colored people weren't welcome in Folk, Arkansas, to live or to work in town. The city put up an almost life-size chalk statue of a colored man at the city limit line. He had an iron bar in one hand and was pointing out of town with the other. The city kept the statue painted and dressed, really taking good care of it. Back in those days, colored people were run out of Folk. One was even hung from a large oak tree. And there's a tree that's still referred to as the hanging tree. The man was hung with a necktie and a red handkerchief. A $5 bill was sticking out of his pocket for any person wanting to bury the man. The story was that the man had come into Folk, committed rape among other things, and was apprehended and hung. Justice was served. The original hanging tree died of natural causes back in the mid-60s. The story's been passed on to another tree that could easily be mistaken for the original tree. My guess is that Folk'll always have a hanging tree, the name being passed down from one tree to another, keeping the story alive. Similar stories about hanging trees are in the folklore in Fairfield, Illinois, Crossville, Tennessee, Robbinsville, North Carolina, and other towns. Just as the trees become mythical, so perhaps have the crimes. And just as the trees keep the stories alive, so the stories keep the policy alive. Towns with strong and extant origin myths seem harder to crack than towns that merely passed an ordinance or expelled their African Americans as part of a wave of such actions, or that have lost their memory of when and why they went sundown. Origin myths that locate a town's anti-black policy in labor conflict seem particularly long-lived. While the punishment, total banning of the race from then on, may be severe, at least a substantial part of the outgroup committed the strike-breaking offense and committed it against us, the white community, or at least a sizable proportion of it. This may explain why residents of towns with such origin myths seem uncommonly forthcoming about their policy. Origin myths about black scabs may also encourage residents to be especially racist toward the next African American who ventures in. Certainly some towns whose origin myths involve black strikebreakers have been particularly vicious toward African Americans for decades afterward. For example, both Pena and Carterville, Illinois, went beyond becoming sundown towns to prohibit blacks from shopping during the daytime as well. Historical contingency, the influence of a single individual. Although the underlying factors discussed in the previous chapter, political history, ethnic makeup, and labor relations, helped to explain which communities went sundown, they didn't determine the outcome. Neither did the catalysts described in this chapter. Individuals also made a difference. Thus, historical contingency inevitably came into play. Even after an interracial rape, an interracial claim for equality, or another form of catalyst, the actions of one person who tries to start, or sometimes stop, a mob can make all the difference. Sociologists who study mass behavior know that crowds go through a period of indecision while they test their own willingness to go further and become a purposeful mob. Then there's usually a further testing process. Members mill about, individuals shout out suggestions, and would-be leaders take tentative steps and gauge the reaction of the rest. Comanche County, Texas embodied the process in the 1880s. It had 8,600 people, including 79 African Americans. Unfortunately for all of the latter, on July 24, 1886, an African-American named Tom McNeil allegedly killed a white farm woman, Sally Stevens. He was captured the next day and taken to the farm and hanged by a lynch mob the day after. Comanche County historian Eulalia Wells describes how one man influenced what happened next. While he dangled, a certain man climbed upon a large stump and spoke, "Boys, this is the second killing of white people by Negroes, and it's more than the people will put up with. I propose we give the Negroes a reasonable time to get out of the county, never allow them to return, and never allow one of color to settle here." According to Billy Bob Lightfoot, a Comanche County native who wrote a master's thesis on its history, that certain man was Green Saunders, who proceeded to denounce African Americans as by nature evil. Following his suggestion, the mob then rounded up the African American community in nearby De Leon and ordered them to come out and bury the corpse, in Lightfoot's words. The crowd then gave the blacks who were burying McNeil's body the warning to pack up and get out within 10 days or be killed. Take what they could, leave what could not be sold or carried, but be across the county line by sunset on August 6, 1886. That evening, the mob visited every black resident in Comanche County with the same message. Whites posted a sign at the train station in De Leon, "Nigger, don't let the sun set on your head in this town." Armed white vigilantes then went door to door throughout Comanche County. The expulsion was followed by a lucrative business in souvenirs carried on by an itinerant peddler who sold authentic remains of the last Negro buried in Comanche County and pieces of the rope used to hang him with, through the county as late as 1889, according to Lightfoot. Comanche County then kept out African Americans, and possibly Mexican Americans, for more than a century. But had Saunders not spoken, or had he been a force for tolerance, another outcome might have ensued. What if just one person had voted differently in Herman, Missouri? Then Herman would have admitted black children to its school, which would have put it on a trajectory toward equal rights for African Americans rather than a descent into policies of racial exclusion. Similarly, we've seen that Sheridan, Arkansas, was poised to make the progressive decision to desegregate its schools. Then, owing to the energy, wealth, and racism of one man, it flip-flopped and got rid of its entire African-American population. One individual can't carry the issue without at least some support from a larger public, however. Having it both ways, the same whites in Wyandotte who blamed the bad behavior of African-Americans for their 1916 expulsion also condemned the leader of the riot, one Carl Eucartz, a town character of irresponsible actions and mental capacity, unable to even formulate good-speaking English. Certainly some individuals are more racist than others, and I'm sure Eucartz led the way. No other whites stopped him, however, and many joined in. The key question is, do those whites willing to keep out African Americans sense that they have at least tacit backing from the police and public? If they do, it only takes a few of them, unfettered by others, to create or maintain a town's racist reputation. Contingency again, the positive influence of an individual. Two adjacent articles in the June 17, 1902 New York Times show how individuals can cause similar events to lead to very different outcomes, outcomes that then persist for decades. The first is headlined, Bitter Race War Threatened. French Lick and West Baden and the valley in which the two famous Indiana health resorts are located bid fair to furnish the next scene of Indiana lawlessness. Both places and the entire length of the valley are threatened with a race war more vicious and more bitter than any that has occurred in the state within the last 10 or 15 years. Already, reports from the two resorts state, whites have posted notices ordering the Negroes to make a hasty evacuation. The notices, tacked to trees and placed in conspicuous places about the grounds of the two prominent hotels, are adorned with skull and crossbone decorations, underneath which is written the ultimatum. All the waiters at the hostelries have received letters, some signed by the words White Cap, declaring that if they do not take their departure at once, they will be horsewhipped. Some, in fact, were threatened with death. The Negroes are terror-stricken, and many have already obeyed the injunction. Many others, however, having been assured protection, are remaining at their posts. Immediately below this story, another dispatch, Race War in Illinois, tells of a similar event 125 miles west in southeastern Illinois. Another attack was made last night on the home of the Reverend Peter Green, pastor of the African Methodist Church at El Dorado. The crowd told Mr. Green to leave town in 24 hours under penalty of death. He defied the mob and stood at his gate with a shotgun, threatening to shoot the first man who molested him. The anti-Negro crusade has at last aroused the respectable white element, and an effort will be made to induce the colored people to reopen the normal and industrial school. El Dorado did force out its black preacher and all his congregation, and the school never reopened. The respectable white element to the contrary. No governing official from the town through the county to the state took any action. According to Robin Williams, a nearby teacher, El Dorado sported a sundown sign until the 1980s. In about 1990, according to someone who was then a resident, a white couple in El Dorado who adopted a biracial child had sewage thrown on their lawn and other problems, and left town shortly thereafter. The next paragraph in the French Lick article, in contrast, tells that the governor has instructed his secretary to notify him immediately upon receipt of any startling information from the valley. Perhaps for that reason, forced eviction of African Americans from the French Lick area did not take place, and French Lick and West Baden Springs have African-American populations to this day. Another public official who did the right thing was Governor Arthur Weaver of Nebraska. In Lincoln, in 1929, a mob of whites drove 200 African-Americans from the city after a white policeman was shot. Weaver ordered that those persons driven out must be permitted to return, and that if any further difficulties ensued, martial law would be instituted. Lincoln stayed interracial. Business leaders could also make a difference. Bronson, in East Texas, expelled its blacks in 1914. Only recently, according to Thad Sitton and James H. Conrad, authors of a fine 1998 study of Texas sawmill towns, were African Americans even allowed to work at the Bronson sawmill. In Dybul, on the other hand, 40 miles west, the mill owner, T.L.L. Temple, didn't want the word nigger spoken, and it wasn't. Dybul remained an interracial town. In Call, Texas, the Ku Klux Klan sent notices to the African-American barber and the black dance hall operator in the 1920s, telling them to leave town. The management of the local sawmill responded by firing some Klansmen, and Call never drove out its African-Americans. Somewhere between 1870 and 1890, John Hay, Abraham Lincoln's secretary during the Civil War, wrote a poem whose full title is Banty Tim, Remarks of Sergeant Tilman Joy to the White Man's Committee of Spunky Point, Illinois. In it, Hay imagines a meeting of Democrats proposing to expel Spunky Point's sole African-American, Banty Tim, to create a sundown town. One white man, Tilman Joy, faces them down, preventing a mob from forming and preserving Spunky Point as interracial. Excerpts follow. I reckon I get your drift, gents. You allow the boy shan't stay. This is a white man's country. You're Democrats, you say. Why, blame your hearts, just hear me. You know that ungodly day when our left struck Vicksburg Heights, how ripped and torn and tattered we lay? Till along toward dusk I seen a thing I couldn't believe for a spell. That nigger, that Tim, was a-crawlin' to me through that fireproof, gilt-edged hell. The rebels seen him as quick as me, and the bullets buzzed like bees. But he jumped for me and shouldered me, though a shot brought him once to his knees. But he staggered up and packed me off with a dozen stumbles and falls, till safe in our lines he dropped us both, his black hide riddled with balls. So, my gentle gazelles, that's my answer, and here stays Banty Tim. He trumped death's ace for me that day, and I'm not going back on him. Hay got several things right, including the white supremacy of the Democrats and the anti-racist idealism stemming from shared experience in the Civil War. After World War II, a latter-day Tilman Joy popped up in New York City in the form of ex-GI Leo Miller. On the East Side, metropolitan life had just opened Stuyvesant Town, a huge housing project for returning veterans. Miller was outraged that MetLife excluded black veterans. The courage and sharp shooting of a Negro machine gunner saved my life with a dozen other white GIs in the Battle of the Bulge, he pointed out. Can any one of us who live in Stuyvesant Town say he may not be my neighbor? I can't. MetLife threatened to evict Miller and other white residents who protested its policy, and even after New York City passed a law in 1951 forbidding racial discrimination in publicly assisted private housing such as Stuyvesant Town, the company refused to accept applications from blacks. But eventually, Miller and his allies won. One man also stood up to the Roosevelt administration in Boulder City, Nevada, one of the eight sundown towns built by the federal government during the Depression. Clarence Newland, owner of the Green Hut restaurant, hired McKinley Sales, African-American, whose pies were the best you could buy anywhere in the state of Nevada, in the estimation of Boulder City resident Robert Parker. Townspeople complained to Sims Eli, the czar of the town under the Roosevelt administration, and Eli told Newland to get rid of Sales. According to Parker, Newland replied, "As long as that Green Hut belongs to me, you're not telling me who to hire and fire around here." Maybe behind many an interracial town lies a white person, or several, who stopped a threatened eviction, which, because it didn't happen, is now lost to history. I know no way to recover the memory of such events, and no way to predict where and when such leaders will occur. We've gone about as far as we can in explaining why certain towns across America went sundown, while others did not. In some towns, whites failed to stop wholesale evictions but did intercede on behalf of an individual person of color. When white residents of Eureka, California, evicted their Chinese population in 1855, eventually only one Chinese-American man, Charlie Moon, was left in Humboldt County. When a group of Eureka residents came to Tom Bear's Redwood Creek Ranch to take his ranch hand, Bear reportedly stood in the road with a gun and told them that they would have to take him first. The men turned around and left. Moon then worked on the Bear Ranch for years and was well-liked and respected. According to historian Linwood Karanko, nobody molested him. James Wilson likewise protected Electa Smith when whites drove all other African Americans from Harrison, Arkansas in 1905 and 1909. According to oral history summarized by David Zimmerman, Wilson met the mob at his door with a shotgun and told them no one in his home was going to be hurt. Another white man in Harrison, George Cotton, didn't go that far, but he did help his black porter escape to safety during the riot, according to Cotton's grandson. Cotton put Nigger George in his buggy at midnight and took him to Eureka Springs, a 12-hour buggy ride. One man also helped to soften the 1918 expulsion of African Americans from Unicoi County, Tennessee, on the North Carolina line. Like so many other expulsions, this one began with an interracial assault. African-American Tom Devert allegedly grabbed a white teenage girl a mile and a half from Irwin, the county seat. Four nearby whites interceded, shooting Devert as he tried to swim across the Nolichucky River with the girl. Whites then tied Devert's body to a locomotive and dragged it back to Irwin. A large mob gathered and the entire black population, between 60 and 70 people, was forced to watch as his body was burned. A reporter for the Bristol Herald paints a dramatic scene. Men with pistols, shotguns, and clubs stood before the lined-up Negroes to prevent their running away. And as the last cross-tie and the last dash of oil was thrown on the heap, one of the men is reported to have turned to the cowering crowd and said, "Watch what we're going to do here. If any of you are left in town by tomorrow night, you'll meet the same fate." Whites would have burned down the black part of Irwin that night, but were dissuaded by General Manager L. H. Fetteplace of the CC&O Railway, according to the account published in the nearby Johnson City Daily. Irwin and Unicoi County went all white the next day. But Fetteplace may have saved some lives that riotous night. John Voight's character in John Singleton's film Rosewood, who helps several African Americans escape from the white riot that destroyed the black community of Rosewood, Florida, is based on a similar person who, in fact, existed. This chapter and its predecessor on sociological causation are first attempts to address why sundown towns came into being. No one's ever tried to answer such questions before. Everything about sundown towns, that the absence of African Americans was involuntary, how widespread they've been, even the origin myths their residents told themselves, has been mystified and left out of history books over the years. The next chapter tells of that mystification. It explains how most Americans came to be ignorant about even the sheer fact of their existence. It also summarizes the methods I used so you can assess my claims to have proven that these towns do exist and were all white on purpose.
Context of white supremacy. I thought we were going one more, but that is it. So we'll pick up next week right at the beginning of Chapter 8, Hidden in Plain View, Knowing and Not Knowing About Sundown Towns. That just sounds like more deception. So the number to dial, if you would like to participate, share a thought, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I think the audio, it got fast forwarded a little bit at the very beginning when we started, so I had to rewind and get it from the beginning, but all good. We were able to hear everything in its entirety. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, if you dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Please do not wait till the last minute if you didn't get to share at all during the first segment. If you know you have comments, do not wait. Go ahead and get your hand up now so that we can hear from you. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Retired firefighter Ivy, Mr. Demery Four, all the other folks, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. The second reading, it kind of like touched on the thoughts that I had of the first reading, where white people were kind of like competing with one another as far as the best racist strategy, refined versus outright brutal and terror, some examples were stated. For the most part, white people are going to exercise strategy that's to their best interest. It's not about justice. It's to their best interest. Most cases, the author is stating the saving of a black life was some black person who cut their grass or something, you know, I believe in one situation I heard Porter or something like that, what the person was doing. I'm pretty sure a lot of black females who were cleaning up behind white people and lazy white women who were not willing to cook food for them, for their own family, and clean up and whatnot. And she probably was either coming back and forth or had quarters within the residence. She was well protected from that standpoint, although there would be some whites who are perhaps jealous of that other white person and would seek to harm that black person. Before I forget, a ridiculous statement that I haven't heard in a long time. I'm trying to think about how it was phrased. Not as racist as another white person. Like, what the hell does that mean? He's not as racist. Yeah, I mean, in other words, that's a typical means of white people practicing racism, to put degrees on mistreatment. You know, the person got stabbed, but at least he didn't stab him 36 times. He just stabbed him 15 times. You know, whatever, I don't know. I'm just making kind of like fun of which is nothing funny about it at all. White people practice racism. But yeah, I heard that statement coming from the author. And right now, that's all I can think of right now as far as with the second read is concerned. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery 4. Person that called in 9029. 9029, if you had commentary, you should be with us.
Peace. Greetings to callers and listeners. And again, Gus, thank you for the platform. First off, page 182, I believe the lower bottom, of the page, in regards to origin myths, he states origin myths tell us why we are here as a people, or why we are the way we are. Often they tell us how to be, how to behave, and that we are right, even God's chosen people. Interesting that he chose that, God's chosen people as well. But I immediately thought about Dr. Joy DeGruy, postmodern slave syndrome, and she used a term called cognitive dissonance. And this is exactly what it seems like, where whites are using this origin myth as an excuse to practice racism, white supremacy. And it's like, literally, I feel like that almost this whole, a lot of this chapter is, a lot of this right now is what we read, is pretty much indicative of that, just excuses to practice what they want to practice anyway, to protect their own feelings of guilt or whatever, so have you, if they even have those feelings. The next page in regards to that 183, where it was speaking about hanging trees, and again, this is another form of, again, I think, like cognitive dissonance, where they made the excuse of Anna Pelley's tombstone and visiting it to keep reliving that same situation and keep perpetuating the same racism, white supremacy within their town. I thought that was extremely interesting. Next one I would head to is, of course, 186, the bottom. I thought this is something I wanted to ask you in regards to, if you've interviewed anybody in regards to this. It's 186, the bottom. Already reports from the two resorts state whites have posted notices ordering Negroes to make a hasty evacuation. But then later on, they said they put notices tacked on trees, skull, cross, and bones decorations. This is one of the things I've been researching more, is white supremacist garments, like their clothing, the symbols, even handshakes and the gestures that they do. I've been trying to figure out more information on this, and I've been looking online, but I haven't found any books, and I wanted to ask you, if you have any books or any suggestions, or anybody on the line has any suggestions as to something to read, because I was recently introduced to the fact that red laces often indicate the person wearing the red laces would be a white supremacist. That is one clothing indication that I was told. And lastly, a man, not moment, on 187, where this is a good section of Black self-respect, where the crowd told Mr. Green to leave the town in 24 hours under the penalty. He defied the mob and stood at his gate with his shotgun, threatening to shoot the first man who molested him. Immediately, it stood out, why was he using the word molest in this? And again, the word was used again on 190 when they were speaking in regards to another person that was supposedly saved by a good white person, which is another act, I think, of racism, white supremacy on the office part, indicating that there are really good whites in this retrospect. And let's just say, even if there are, the fact that they are so few that he could sum them up in like three pages is ridiculous. Say all that, and I'll mute my line. I have a few more statements, but I'd like to hear everybody's comment. And again, in regards to racist white symbols, if we've interviewed anybody like that or have any suggestions, anybody on the line. Thank you. Peace.
Much obliged, sir. NPR just had an author on who was talking about the paraphernalia, white supremacist paraphernalia. I think I just played the audio segment on the compensatory call-in this past weekend, but she was talking about the symbolism of like the Klan robes and other racist garments, racist symbols, and how that got linked when they picked those symbols. That was just on NPR this weekend. That's one that I know of. I can see about finding that title. While I'm searching, Ivy, any other folks who dialed in Mr. Demery for have commentary that they wanted to share?
Yes, sir. Thank you. It stood out to me as well, the not as racist comment. This author, he keeps putting degrees on racism, like the firefighter said. And he said, towns keep us from living in them. No, they don't. White people do that. Talked about an anti-Negro crusade and an anti-Black policy. No, these are not anti-Negro or anti-Black. These are just racist. These are, you know, racist policies from racist people and racist crusades from racist people. He made a statement about vigilantes. When I think of vigilantes, I think of people who think of themselves as doing something that should be done, doing something that is correct, because the people who are in charge are not doing the correct thing. Racists are not vigilantes. What they are is terrorists. They know good and well that what they are doing is incorrect, and that the people that are in charge, they do the same thing, and they know that those people are also doing incorrect things. He made a statement about, I believe he talked about, I think it was the kicking Black people out. He called some sort of terrorist, some sort of terrorist attack an epidemic. When I think of that, I think of just this outbreak that just kind of happened, where it wasn't really intentional and it was all unexpected and this, that, and the other. Whereas no, racism is not an epidemic. What it is, anytime you see these, I guess, acts of violence and terrorism, they're all very much planned. And white people are very meticulous and dedicated, as you would say, to what they do, to their terrorism. So this is not some kind of disease or some kind of just thing that just happened. This was orchestrated. This racism, period, is orchestrated, and all the racist acts are orchestrated in advance. And he was making statements about white people being scared of us. I'm gonna say it again: they are not. They never have been, because they never would have abused us if they were scared, and they wouldn't continue to abuse us if they are scared. We don't abuse them because we are scared of them. There was a name he said, Nigger George, reminds me of Nigger Pete, who was referenced earlier in the book, and Nigger Jim, who was referenced in Huckleberry Finn. And that was it, and I will mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Any other folks have comments that they wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, just a few points. I noticed that in the reading, in these sundown towns, or before they became, it was also a czar, a racist czar in the town, or head racist, you know, that would vehemently, you know, try to excite mobs into harming Blacks and running them out of town. And
if I'm not mistaken, didn't I hear him describe a lynch mob, what they were thinking in their mind and how it happens and, you know, what he's actually doing, you know, and I don't know where he got that information, but I guess it takes one to know one. Anyway, he mentioned when he started talking about the benevolent whites, he mentioned the movie Rosewood and Angelique Jolie's father, John Vogt, was a character in there that was supposed to have been a benevolent white and it's supposed to have been based on a single person. He didn't have a person's name and he didn't bring up the fact that John Vogt was raping a young black girl that was working in his store, you know, which prompted him to maybe try to, you know, preserve the lives of her and probably her fathers and brothers. And, you know, I can't remember the movie now, but I can remember him, you know, reluctantly helping, you know, because of the rape that he had perpetrated on a young woman. And this mention of Falk, Arkansas, I'd said before that that place really exists. And I was talking to my brother on the phone that still lives in that area, and he said the sign is still up there. With, you know, I couldn't hardly believe, but I mean, it probably is. Nothing is unbelievable when it comes to these races. I'll mute my line. Gus, thanks for taking the call.
Wow, if the sign is still up, I would love a picture if that is safe to obtain, but I am not surprised. Wow. And other folks, again, we'll be reading this book for, you know, some more weeks. So share, check around your area. If you hear towns that are in close to where you are or where you have relatives and friends, ask questions. Check. Did you know? see what folks are aware of. Local, national, global system of racism. So the text, the caller who was asking about clothing or paraphernalia, racist paraphernalia, what I was referencing, it's a white woman. Her name is Kelly Baker. She just wrote an essay, The Artifacts of White Supremacy. And it talks about specifically the Klan appropriated Christian imagery and objects to brand themselves, recruit members, and attempt to gain legitimacy. She says white supremacists use the white robe, fiery cross, and even the American flag as an attempt to make their beliefs more tangible and performative. But that seems like it might be leaning in the direction of what you were checking about. Her article, again, The Artifacts of White Supremacy. Kelly Baker, suspected racist. Things, notes that I took from this chapter or the portion that we just read. The Forsyth purge, we've talked with about that incident a lot. We had an author, a white author, he wrote about that incident more recently. That's another one where white children participated and went around putting up the notices to kick the niggers out. He had a lot of detail. I think that's September 2016. We discussed that event. We've discussed it repeatedly. Let's see. The situation in Corbin, I didn't even know that he was going to reference Trouble Behind, but that's the audio clip that I played, and then he mentioned Corbin, and I checked the footnotes, and he referenced that documentary film, the one that I started with. The white man had a dog named Nigger and talked about him being shiny and black, and he walked right into that one talking about how the origin myth, the lie that was given that the black males were on the railroad and stealing and robbing, and so that's why they had to kick all of the niggers out. You should check that documentary out if you can find it online on Trouble Behind. Let's see. Agree with Ivy's point when they were talking to the whites from Forsyth on Oprah. I think that Oprah Winfrey segment is online. You can watch that too. That's interesting. The lie, she says, I have a fear of black. I did have a fear of black people. An excuse to practice racism, white supremacy, sounding like the white killer of Michael Brown Jr. back in 2014. I was so scared that I'm going to turn into an alien. Let's see. I thought it was really important as well. They've made a pilgrimage in Anna to go back to this coffin. Whites kill and maim people all the time. How many white people have killed? How much white on white crime have they had in that area over the past 50 years? Did they make a pilgrimage to go and mourn about that? They got the Columbine massacre right now. They didn't make a pilgrimage. They had a white woman who traveled all the way from Florida to go up there and made threats about doing some more killing. Next, let's see. He got some of the people that have talked about the tone of the book. He has such great anecdotes. He has this anecdote, Smokey Crabtree, a longtime resident of Folk, F-O-U-K-E, in Arkansas. He gives him this great anecdote about why there are no Negroes there. And he says that they had the hanging. The Negro was hung with a necktie and a red handkerchief. A $5 bill was sticking out of his pocket for any person wanting to bury the man. I thought that was important. Total desecration of black people in life and death. And we had so many examples of desecrating black corpses. He committed rape, among other things. Of course, we got feverish Negroes, of course. Let's see. Let's see. Oh, the expulsion was followed by a lucrative business and souvenirs carried out by an itinerant peddler who sold authentic remains of the last Negro buried in Comanche County and pieces of the rope used to hang him with. Now, is that delectable, Negro? The religion of white supremacy. But I mean, wow. And back to what we were talking about last week, consumption of black male corpses. That is all day, every day, worldwide, in the system of white supremacy. They said they were talking about how the whites terrorized and moved out black people in one area, and they said the Negroes are terror-stricken. Now, that's Mr. Lowen quoting from a New York Times report. That's not him, but I just found that. That from 1902, the New York Times recognizes that the black people are terror-stricken. Mr. Lowen, we're not using terror-stricken to describe, or terrorism. That's not how these acts are being described. Race relations and such. The anecdote, he said, he's talking about El Dorado in Illinois. He said, in about 1990, according to someone who was then a resident, a white couple in El Dorado who adopted a biracial child had sewage thrown on their lawn and other problems and left town shortly thereafter. Now, I checked the footnote. Now, this is from an employee at a Illinois university through email correspondence. But I mean, wow, raw sewage thrown on the lawn. You brought in a biracial child, quote unquote, could have been. Never mind, I was thinking President Obama. Let's see. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? I thought the last few portions that kind of focused on these kindly whites, as Mr. Demiforce said, who intervened to save a black person, I just thought that was absurd. Again, the preponderance. And exactly as Mr. Demiforce said also, it's not like these whites aren't racist. They could have had their own, you know, motivations for why they wanted to do this. But to have that, you know, focus that, oh, there were some kindly whites who could have done something or did do something to save the day. Even the situation in Rosewood. Oh, and also there were no footnotes for some of these kindly whites who did these acts. There was no reference. Like, where is this to justify the same thing that Mr. Lowen just said? I kind of look sideways at all of this. You know, there's so many lies around these stories, and he's not even willing to accurately label them as lies. These kindly whites could have been a lie, too. They love to slip in a Heather Hare. They love to slip in a John Brown. They love to have a Kyle Korver as playoff basketball. They love to have a kindly white woman, a kindly white man who gave a black person a piece of cornbread or kept them from getting shackled or raped or whatever. That totally misses the preponderance. You got thousands of whites, not one obscure, thousands of whites coming out for one lynching, white women coming out in droves. Make the preponderance so that we don't get confused about what it means to be white. It doesn't mean Heather Hare at all, unless she's identified as a suspected racist too. I'll maybe get in one more comment before we call it a wrap. Let's see. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, this would be a good one. In the last paragraph, he says, the next chapter tells of that mystification. It explains how most Americans came to be ignorant, even about the sheer fact, it explains how most Americans came to be ignorant about even the sheer fact of their existence, meaning these sundown towns. I can only emphasize anytime that I see this. And he used the term Americans. I think it should have been identified as white people specifically are right there. I'm sure there are black people, including myself, who didn't know about some of this information previously. But I mean, we should be talking specific here. You're saying that white people are ignorant about this. They make up these lies. They come up with these phrases or what have you. And then it gets to a point where they don't even know that all of this happened. I'm saying that I think that that is an absolute lie, even if they don't have all of the exact details, the exact date, the exact race soldiers who did the castrating or the lynching or whatever else was involved. White people, I just go back to what Mr. Lowen said, man, you will get a notice. You will be tapped on the shoulder. You'll get a text message, an email. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. Maybe they don't know all the details about how there's no niggers in their town, but you can believe they know what a nigger is and whether or not a nigger is supposed to be in Anna or any other area. And I'll hush there. We did our 3 hours. We'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. Same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have thoughts, questions, comments on the text, something stood out, something doesn't make sense, if you see some other areas where Mr. Lowen is practicing white supremacy, lots of opportunities for that, you can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged to all the folks who participated, emailed. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We're already accused of being no count. Feverish, rogues anyway, best to keep our brain computers working well so that we can correctly solve the problem, efficiently go about trying to solve this problem, and do as much as we can to try to keep ourselves safe from whites who are dedicated to terrorizing black people, non-white people worldwide. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.